I had went to a party with him and he had assaulted me and kind of downplayed it. He, a bunch of things. I won't go too in depth, but he downplayed it. And the same response kind of stuck in my head from like when it happened, when I was, right before I left. And so I didn't say anything. And then it happened a few more times on deployment and at the end of deployment and after deployment. And so it was a lot of stuff that kind of just kept like happening. And I just kept tucking it down, not talking about it because I was just really scared that no one would believe me. Because, like, the way the ship is, if someone gets assaulted and they reach out for help, they get called a boat hoe and say, oh, no, it wasn't him. It had to be her. She's such a hoe, blah, blah, blah.
Welcome to Your Story Doesn't End Here, the mental health podcast of military and veterans who refuse to be silenced. I'm your host, Rachel, and my mission with this podcast is to be a voice for those who don't have a voice, bring awareness to mental health issues, provide value and solutions, and to change the culture when it comes to mental health within the DoD organizations. Hey everyone, and thank you so much for coming back for another episode of Your Story Doesn't End Here. Today's guest is Brittany, and Brittany and I have met, or we met when I want to say it was like a year, 2 years ago. It was a while ago. And I believe we met on social media. I cannot remember exactly how. I think we said it was like a veterans group of some sort. And I think we had some mutual friends and served at the same base. And this little corner of the Pacific Northwest is such a small area. Like it is, but it isn't. And so we had gone out to eat one time together and have not seen each other since in person. So I'm so glad that you're on the show today. I've been wanting to have you on for a while. I know you've been so busy doing your own thing with, school and babies and life. And so I'm just grateful that you took the time to be here today. So thank you so much, first of all, for being here. And then if you could please just tell the listeners a little bit more about who you are and where you come from.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. Yes, we have to plan some in-person things. So my name is Brittany. I have been in the mental health field for about 6 years now. Prior to this, I was in the Navy. I was stationed on the Nimitz. And I'm from Florida originally. I'm just really passionate about mental health. I have my bachelor's in psychology. I have my master's in advanced clinical social work and practice. I just graduated in August and I worked hard to kind of get to that place and build up to this moment. I've recently opened up my own private practice, which is exciting for me, but also scary at the same time because it's a 1099 deal. So I don't get paid by the hour. I get paid per the client, which is okay. It's just something that's new and exciting.
That is incredible. And, I've been seeing you from the social media side, like being a mom and going to school and being a human being in general, which is a full-time job in itself sometimes. And I just have so much respect for all the work that you've put in. And so congratulations on opening your practice. Mm-hmm. And I would love to just take it back a little bit in your story to your time when you served in the military. Tell us a little bit about your experience when you were active duty.
So I was an ABE. Those of you who know, it was really difficult. It was long working hours, really hard on everyone's mental health. I've, confided in I've been out of the military for a while, so I'm like, what?
Shipmates. That sounds a little weird,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah. I've confided in my friends that I made while I was in, and they would confide in me. I also did like collateral duties while I was in too. I was on the emergency import team or import emergency team. It's been a while. And I was a sapper advocate as well, because I have faced my own traumas before, before the military and while I was in the military as well, which kind of helped drive me to the point that I'm at right now. Because I know when I was younger, or even while I was in the military, it was hard to seek help. One, because like I'm from the South and mental health like did not exist down there. And two, like in the military, you kind of get instilled with that thought that if you speak out about your mental health, you're going to lose your clearance. You're going to be kind of an outcast or transferred or whatever. So it was scary for me. And on my deployment when I was 19, I almost took my life. So it was really hard for me. So I had battled with my mental health for years and I finally reached out to a therapist. So this therapist has a therapist, which is okay too. And I started taking like sertraline and it's helped me out substantially with my mental health. I'm at such a great place right now because I also equip myself with like coping skills and hobbies. I'm a total plant mom. I have like 50 house plants. There's so many downstairs. And yeah, I think all my experience, like the good side of my life and also like the bad stuff that's happened really put me in this place to where I am now. And I really just find enjoyment in helping people because I want people to know a lot of these things are just situations in life. They're not going to last forever. And it's really hard to see it at the time that you're in that really bad place, that there's no way out, but there is. Like, had I done that when I was 19, I wouldn't have helped as many people as I helped. I wouldn't have my husband, my kids, my family, the place that I'm in right now, the work that I'm doing. So I'm really glad that I kind of shoved that down a little bit and just kind of dealt with it internally, which I do not recommend, but I had to keep going. And then when I had my daughter, that was my anchor to kind of hold me here and my family. And then now it's myself, which I never thought that I would want to live for myself, but I do. And for my kids and husband and family and everyone. Yeah. So I've just been kind of pushing forward and teaching people like, you know, this is situational and it's going to get better. May not feel like it, but it will.
That's incredible. I love that piece that you said about living for yourself. I was like, that's so powerful because I think so many of us out there forget about us, as crazy as that sounds and as like simple as it sounds. It sounds like it's obvious that we would be living for us. I think innately we do because we're human beings. But I think from a mental and emotional standpoint, a lot of human beings find something outside of themselves to live for, which is okay if that's what we need in that moment. But there's so much power in being able to finally say, I am living for me. And so I'm so grateful you said that. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that deployment and what was going on at the time that you were at such a low space when you were 19?
Yeah. So prior to actually going in the military, I think months before for boot camp, I was actually assaulted. I was at this party, which was the other person's friend, and no one believed me, even though someone saw it happen. No one believed me. My best friend believed me of her so much. She tried to advocate for me as best as she could, but it was just kind of shunned. So that moment where, you know, no one believed me. I couldn't tell my parents because I was, you know, I was snuck out. I was doing stuff I wasn't supposed to do. So I was scared. So I kind of tucked that down and pretended like it never happened. Then when I was in the military, I was in A school. I met someone there and they're like, oh, you're from the Nimitz. And I said, yeah, like I'm going to be stationed there. And I guess he was from there too. He was at C school. I can't remember what it's called, C school. So then when I got to the Nimitz, I met up with him again because I was like, okay, this is somebody like that I knew from like A school. And, you know, it's somebody that I know in this area because I don't know anyone else. Well, this was like 2 weeks because when I got there, it was like 2 weeks until deployment. And I had went to a party with him and he had assaulted me and kind of downplayed it. He, you know, a bunch of things. I won't go too in depth, but he downplayed it. And the same response kind of stuck in my head from like when it happened when I was, you know, right before I left. And so I didn't say anything. And then it happened a few more times on deployment and at the end of deployment and after deployment. And so it was a lot of stuff that kind of just kept like happening. And I just kept tucking it down, not talking about it because I was just really scared that no one would believe me because like the way the ship is, if someone gets assaulted and they reach out for help, they get called a boat hoe and say, oh no, it wasn't him, it had to be her, she's such a hoe, blah blah blah. So that's what I was scared of, because like I think on the ship, like I got there at like 4 a.m. and by the time it's 7 or 8 a.m. rolled around, automatically had rumors. I was like, wow, like that was really quick. That was quicker than high school. I haven't even met anybody here yet. So it was just a lot of pressure on me, and me being like not used to being away from my family because we were so tight knit, going from Florida to Washington on a ship, dealing with like different people I've never met before. It was just a really scary experience overall. Like, of course, no one's going to believe me. I just got here. Why would something happen to me if I just got here? So I kind of kept that in my entire time in the Navy. And when I was getting out and I did my VA stuff, the psychiatrist was a male, and he told me that if I didn't report it and put it in my medical record, it didn't happen. So I was able to, once that claim was denied, I was able to reach out to the VA, let them know that I wanted a woman, because I felt like there was a lot of bias there, because he was just kind of attacking my character when that's not what his purpose was. And so I got her, I told her what happened. She was just infuriated. She was infuriated by what he said. And when she was doing my evaluation on me, I was so scared. Like, I was like shaking. I was having like a panic attack while I was talking to her, because I was retelling something that I just had stuffed down. Because the first time that I finally told someone, it was that male psychiatrist, and just immediately shut down and brought me back to when it first happened. So I was grateful for her. And then she recommended me into therapy, and it really had a huge change in my life. I did a little therapy while I was on the boat for like a few months, but I was still cautious about it, so it was a little harder. So I asked for like an out-of-network provider, so for mental health therapy, because I was just like, this will make me more comfortable. And my therapist is great. I still see her to this day, not as much as I used to. I see her every few months. I just kind of trauma dump on her and kind of talk about how life's going, because I'm at that place to where I don't need to see her every week. And I've been through a lot. I've used this experience and everything to kind of have that common ground. But being a therapist, you have to walk that fine line of self-disclosure. You can't turn it into your session, you know, and just talk about everything that's bad that's happened to you. You have to have that really clear line, but it's okay to just kind of find that common ground there, because I don't ever want any of my clients to think that I'm like this perfect being who is just all knowing and has her life completely put together, because I'm not. Sometimes, you know, like, life is never put together. Stuff happens. Nothing's ever planned. I know mine. I'm just like, oh my gosh, because they'll walk in like, oh, how are you doing today? And I probably just had like the worst morning this week. And I'm like, I've had a rough morning, but you know what? I'm going to push through it. And they're like, oh, okay, same. So,
but I love that you're honest about that.
Yeah, because I want it to be like a humanizing experience. Like, it can be so, people can be like, dehumanize you whenever you have a mental health diagnosis. I hate it. I was in the ER because I have had issues with my blood pressure since I had my last son, had severe preeclampsia with him. And so it just fluctuates a lot. And I went to the ER and the doctor was like, oh, I see you have anxiety on your chart. It must be an anxiety attack. And I was like, sir, I've had anxiety for years. This is not what this is. So he was like, well, let me give you an Ativan and just see if it calms you down. I was like, okay, well, I'm super sensitive to medication, because like anything that's like sedating, I need like the lowest dose possible, because my midwife called me a cheap date because I couldn't handle like the pain meds they were giving me during my C-section. But I'm like, oh, that's a lot for me. I don't take anything normally. So like, other than my sertraline, which isn't sedating. So they gave me the lowest dose of Ativan, and he's like, well, you know, revisit it. How are you feeling now with your symptoms? I said the same, because it's not anxiety. I'm just a little groggy now. Because you just gave me Ativan, like, so it was like really dehumanizing, not to mention like hearing the front desk clerks talk about someone in there that was struggling with the mental health crisis. And she said something that was just so repulsing. And I like reported it, because I was like, no, that's absolutely not professional. Because she was so loud. She's like, oh, I just love it when the crazies come in here. It just makes the day riveting. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, someone's at a really bad point in their life and you're dehumanizing them like they're an animal in a zoo. I was really angry. I looked over at my husband and I said, oh, she's like, I'm having some issues right now with my blood pressure, because it was just ridiculous. So yes, dehumanizing experience overall, like, but I want to like normalize mental health struggles. So I tell my client, like when I'm doing my therapist disclosure, I'm like, listen, there's nothing wrong being in therapy. So a lot of people feel shame. I tell them, I'm like, you know what? I have a therapist. Maybe my therapist has a therapist. I'm not sure, but maybe her therapist has a therapist, and so on and so forth, until they get to a boss therapist that just takes care of everyone. Yeah. So I explain it to them to kind of add some comedic relief, but to also let them know, like, it's okay to reach out for help. It's okay to get therapy. I have no issues with like getting therapy, it's nice to be able to talk to someone from an unbiased standpoint, like the parts of my life that I probably would never tell anybody else. So yeah, if you're listening and you need therapy, just like, don't be afraid to get help. It changed my life. So,
you know, I think you spoke a lot to the toxicity in the military when you were talking about your experience on the boat. And so I wanted to touch on that really quick. And then hopefully I remember all the other things I want to touch on because my brain can bounce around a lot. So
yeah, mine too.
If not, we'll maybe touch on it before the episode ends. But so the boat experience, what was interesting to me that I think I've heard from a lot of people, and we see this experience happen a lot throughout the Navy. I can't speak to other branches. I'm sure it happens in other branches too, is this idea that when a female comes to a boat or a command, there is a certain stigma just behind being a female. You're a boat ho, or oh, you look like you party a lot. I mean, I know in commands that I was at, they would check out the Facebook pages and be like, oh, she looks like she parties a lot, because, like, you know, Facebook obviously is a synopsis of your entire life. So if all you have is party photos, mm-hmm. obviously you're a partier. Kidding. That was sarcasm for anyone listening. Yeah. but I was curious if when you were going through like boot camp and A school leading up to your first command, if the culture surrounding sexual assault and women in the military, if it was more of a supportive culture, or if it still emulated that culture of, oh, you're just a hoe, or you're just a slut, or you're just, you know, trying to get attention if you report. Because I know what my experience was in A school when I saw other women that reported sexual assault. And so I was curious if yours was the same, and if that kind of like laid a framework for your experience on your first command on the boat.
So in boot camp, the RDCs were just like the RDCs, so I can't really speak for them. But everyone else, like, it was really collaborative and they were really supportive to each other. Like, there wasn't any of that there for me or that I've seen. Now in like A school, there was a lot of stuff. Like, my roommate had been drugged and the front was trying to tell, I forgot what the front part's called, but it's been so long. It was like 2000.
Is it like the quarter deck area?
You mean? Yeah, I think kind of like one of the barracks. But they were saying that she's just drunk and she got in trouble, but she was like drugged. She got drugged by someone off base, or not off base. It was at that port bar side? Thing.
You're in Pensacola.
Yeah.
Port side.
Yeah, that one. But other than that, like, I've heard like things left and right there that have happened, but nothing geared towards me personally, other than like meeting that person and then that happening. So yeah, I'm not sure. A school was a little bit different. The disrespect towards me, yes.
Yeah.
It was there, you know, because I was I was like, okay, that sets the tone. Like, I feel like it's gonna be way worse when I get out there to the fleet, and it definitely was.
Yeah.
Not anyone in my work center though. They were all great. We had more men than we did women.
That's so cool,
and a lot of our guys, I'm still friends with a lot of them, and they're really supportive and really kind of protective of the women in there, which was great. It's the ones outside of her work center. And yeah, so like those other people were outside. One of them that had assaulted me was a Marine. The other one he was in the Navy, but I can't remember which part, but he was outside of our work center. And then whenever I was cranking, like, some guy just like forced himself on me in the laundry room and like kissed me. And I'm just like, what the heck? Like, that's disgusting. And like the higher ups too, like one would try to rub my shoulders and I'm like, oh, like, don't, please don't touch me. So yeah, it was a lot of different things, a lot of like stuff that's super just uncomfortable to even think about because of how common it was.
Oh, yeah. And
there was this one, I think first class actually, who had molested like a lot of the younger sailors in his work center. He got sent to
captain's mast.
No, worse,
like the brig.
Yeah. What's like that? Is it NJP?
Oh, what was it, court martial or something?
Yes, court martial.
I'm trying to remember all the terms. Yeah, Because yes, there's a judicial one, and then the NJP, and NJP was the one in front of the CO, and I think court martial was the one where it's like a whole like court proceeding under the military system.
Yeah, I think it was the court proceeding one because he got sent to like some like military prison. But those people, like, they were in a different work center than me, but like the same division, and they kind of grouped together to be able to speak up and reach out. There were male and females that happened to in that work center. So it's not only, you know, females that get assaulted. It's just like, I think when it happens to males, they don't speak out as much because the stigma that's behind that, like, oh, well, a lot of people say, oh, well, a male can't get assaulted. And that is not true. And it's just honestly like the toxicity. I hope that it's getting better for people. I'm not sure. I haven't been in since 2016, but hopefully in the future it does get better for them as far as being able to talk about mental health. Because on deployment, I think like 3 people committed suicide. And then one committed suicide whenever he was getting transferred because he's going to his next duty station. He committed suicide. And then we had one that he just kind of got picked on a lot and he ended up getting like committing suicide. So suicide is a huge issue, I think, in the military in general. I don't think it's covered enough. You know, we have those suicide prevention trainings or be like a good bystander ones, but I feel like they don't support it enough that they're just doing the trainings just to say that they did it.
Right.
You know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of things that are checking the box and in the military in general. And I think it's because when we're doing a training, it's very hard for people to feel the emotions behind why something needs to change. And so, you know, when you're staring at a PowerPoint, no one wants to be there anyway. And it's like, oh man, I got so much work to do. And there's so many things that are going through someone's mind when they're active duty. And then you say, oh, your training's due next week. Make sure you do your training. Everyone's like, oh shit. Let me run to the training room really quick, click through this, and then that's it. Well, that's not actually making an impact. And the purpose of these trainings is to make an impact. But someone told me the other day, there's like 300 something different like Navy or military DOD policies that have something to do with mental health. And I feel like there's so many that it's like not actually helping, that someone needs to sit down and be like, okay, how can we actually help prevent suicides? The suicides that happened on your ship, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but do you know how they took their lives?
I only know about one, like the details of one. We were in port somewhere. I can't remember which port it was, but he had hung himself. The other couple, I'm not sure. My low moment was like, I think it was like 3 o'clock in the morning and I was on the catwalk. I took off like my float coat, got up on the rails, kind of like that Titanic moment where Rose is overlooking the water. And it was like the same thing. I was just kind of looking down. I'm like, you know, like I could just do this and I won't have to deal with anything anymore. And it was like a lot of thought that I was like, okay. But then I managed to just like think about, because it was the anniversary of my aunt's death. I loved her so much and she passed away unexpectedly. So it was that anniversary. So it was that I had just gotten assaulted a few weeks prior. And I just felt like I was just alone. And yeah, I was just thinking about how like my family kind of fell apart a little bit after my aunt died and how bad that impacted my mom because I was like her best friend. I was like, oh, I can't put my mom through this. I can't put my dad through this. So then I like kind of stepped down and just went back to sleep. And like nothing happened and just kind of tucked it away. So at that time, like I said earlier, I was like living for my family. And then each life event, it kind of progressed into living for other things and adding it in. And then, like I said earlier, like now, like I'm living for myself. It's just unfortunate that a lot of people don't get to make it to that point. So it definitely can feel like the world's against you.
So the reason I asked that question is because when you talk about dehumanizing versus humanizing, I think when a lot of the boat stories are very like what happens on the boat stays on the boat. And yeah. I've never been on a carrier, destroyer. I have not stepped foot on a single Navy boat of any type, even though I served 6.5 years. And so I never really get an insight into that world, but I've heard little bits and pieces from people who have seen some really horrific things happen on the boat. And I think it's important for the people listening to this podcast to know that, like, you know, a lot of people take their lives via firearms or pills or something, right? But when you are out in the middle of a floating city, there are horrific things that people do because they are in so much pain. I mean, I've heard of people tying chains around their ankles and jumping off, or, you know, like you said, just jumping off in general. And it's really, really sad that people get to that point where they feel like that's the only option. I think the Brandon Act, the guy that had taken his life, that started that whole, his family started that whole initiative for the Brandon Act. I'm pretty sure he walked into rotating helicopter blades. I mean, you have to be in so much pain emotionally to even have the thought in your head to do what someone on a boat is doing to take their life, and not to negate from people that are not on a ship in the forms that they take their life or attempt to. But it really is a separate world that I think needs to be discussed. And especially with the number of suicides that happen on carriers in these boats that kind of, you know, make a newspaper article and then it just kind of goes away. And then, you know, like we kind of talked about earlier, nothing's really done about it other than like little things here and there. I personally think there needs to be like a massive overhaul change that just sends that message to the military of it. We actually care about your mental health. I don't think the little things here and there are enough. So as far as, you said you got out in 2016?
Yes.
Okay. When you got out of the military, did you feel like you were in a great emotional place, or was the VA thing kind of like the tipping point for you?
No, when I got out, it was so hard for me. So I tried to be a stay-at-home mom, and being a stay-at-home mom is hard in itself. But I was so used to like just constantly like working and putting myself on overdrive and everything, that just sitting at home, I was like, oh my gosh, like I've watched all the seasons of Supernatural and Grey's Anatomy, like hard for me. Cause like I was postpartum, all my hormones, everything, also like everything that happened, and just all that kind of packed in, like in the VA, psychiatrist too, just kind of added into that. And then my ex-husband, which is my daughter's dad, he had like done something not intentional. He was being playful, but he didn't know my past at all. He didn't know anything that's ever happened to me. And he like accidentally triggered me. And I had such a horrible response. And then after that, like, that was like the floodgates open. Like, it was so hard for me. Like, I was having like flashbacks and everything, like over the next like couple years. And like, even I was like, okay, well, you know, well, maybe it's because I'm at home. Maybe I need to get a job. So then I like got a job. It was hard for me. I was having like these flashbacks even at work and have these breakdowns. And I had to just like, I quit that job because I was like, I need to do something to fix this, because it got to the point where if I even went to like a convenience store and someone like, if there was a guy standing behind me, I would immediately start having like a panic attack. And it would just get so bad to the point to where I didn't even like leaving the house. Unless like I had to, or I was with somebody, but never by myself. And it was like that for so long. And I finally was able to get a referral to therapy, which was a huge life changer for me. And I was able to like talk about this stuff, which is why it's so easy for me to talk about it now, because like I realized, okay, if I hold all this in, it's going to destroy me. And now I'm very open about my mental health. Like even my, pretty sure like at my other place of employment, they know I'm very open about it. I'm like, oh, hey, I got to run back home. I forgot to grab my meds, you know, different things like that. Cause I want to normalize it. Like, I feel like it's so important to normalize, like, it's okay to take medication. Like, it's okay to go to therapy. It's okay to not have a good day today. Do whatever you can to just survive through it. Like, so I try to be very open with people about stuff. Client-wise, self-disclosure line, like I said before, I got to be very careful with that. But like friend-wise and just like kind of talking to people out in the community too, like I'm so open about it.
So with you going into the field of actually helping others with their mental health, was that inspired, catalyzed by your personal experiences, or was there something else that made you want to go into that field?
I'm not sure. I think it's all of it, because even when I was younger, I'd have people come to me for like advice and everything. Just seeing like the impact that happens, like if people's mental health aren't taken care of, like that kind of pushed it too. And then I was like, you know what? Because I think I want to be like, what did I want to be? I think it was like a neuropsychologist or something like that. But I can't write a dissertation. That is just a lot of work. So my very first job in this field was I worked psychiatric inpatient involuntary, which was really difficult. And I worked there as a recovery specialist. Then I kind of changed gears to be a peer counselor there because I had gone through it, you know, and I was in a good place to be able to kind of open up. Because with like peer counseling, that self-disclosure is pretty wide open. So I was able to help people in that way and just kind of build rapport and that trust there. And then after that, I'm trying to think of my timeline in my head. I did take a break from it for a while and I worked with CPS. That was hard. So I had a pregnancy complication too with that. Actually, prior to that, I worked on the suicide prevention line. And that one was heartbreaking. A lot of calls. Like people needing to talk, which is like good, because you don't have to be suicidal to call one of those lines. If you just need emotional support, you can still call them. And then a lot of people actively trying to take their life on the phone, and it's like a race against time because they're not going to tell you their location. So I had to pull out some FBI skills to try and find it. And I was able to like get EMS there to help them because it's so scary. So I've built like a really good like barrier in between that, because those were some hard calls. Even like now I work with a high risk population and it's difficult to hear that stuff. So I had to put up a barrier and leave it at work, not take it home with me just to preserve my own mental health. Because I have to come home and focus on like my kids and my husband and myself. And I can't do that if I just have everyone's thing that they just told me about playing through my head, which it took a long time to really build up that barrier.
I was going to say, how do you decompress after a day of work in either the past where you were working with involuntary CPS suicide prevention, or even now? Do you have certain, I think you said you have hobbies, but what's your typical end of day decompression?
Right now, I play video games like Rocket League or like this game called Stray that I'm trying to beat, but I keep dying. But it's just a way to kind of just shut off my brain and not like, I tell my family, like when I get home, I just need 20 minutes of like just no one talking to me because I've been talking to people for 8 hours straight. I just need like 20 minutes where I sit outside of my car for like 20 minutes before walking in the house and just kind of having that moment to just quiet my brain down. But I play video games, playing with my husband. I'm not sure if it's a good coping skill because they make me so mad.
Yeah, honestly, I think people underestimate the power that like just something simple, because often when we talk about like self-care, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people overthink it and they're like, oh, I gotta go get like a massage, or I gotta, you know, draw a bubble bath. But like literally just something like watching a movie or playing a video game, I think that's self-care, because it's something you're, as long as you're doing it for you, anything is self-care.
It totally counts as a distraction too. I also have plants, as I told you earlier. So on Sundays, that's water day. Oh my gosh, it takes me an hour and a half to water all of my plants. So that counts immensely as a distraction, because then I like, you know, pick off like their old leaves or repot them or fix my vines on my wall. So it's like an activity that's solely for me that I find like enjoyment in.
And they help the energy and the air too. A lot of plants inside your house, I've heard. So
okay, I love my plants. I have like, let's see, I have like 3 Monstera Albos.
Are those the ones with the big leaves?
Yeah, the big green ones with white on there.
Okay.
I have like the pole itself, like with the plant is like 6 foot tall, but it spans up my wall by like 5 feet. So I would say my pothos is now like 11 feet.
Wow.
I have so many of them. So that's cool. I don't even know what like half the names are anymore, because I'm just like, you get water and you get water, because
that's cool.
Yeah, so I really find enjoyment in that. Also, just like I used to paint a lot, but I haven't in a while. It's been a long time. I really want to get back into it, because that was my main thing. That was the one thing that could distract me for literally hours, and I would find so much peace in it. And it's also like a rewarding experience for like when you finish, you know. So I love painting. I just haven't had time to do it in a while, and I really want to.
You should. I remember seeing your, I think you did like, what was it, digital artwork a few years back or something that was like really cool. And you did some kind of artwork, I remember, that I saw online that was like really cool. Oh, I'll have to.
Let me unblur my screen.
She's showing me her artwork if you're listening. And so I'll have to screenshot and then post that for everyone to see it. But that's really cool. I think if you have the ability to draw a face and have it actually look like a face, you're already winning in the world.
I know. My daughter, actually, she's getting into drawing, which makes me so happy. Because I'm like, okay, that's the age that I started at. Like, I want her to be able to be, like, you know, find enjoyment in art. But she's such a perfectionist. But like she does it the way she does it, because she's 8. It's so wild, because like she'll watch like the tutorials, or she'll read like the books that I give her, because I give her like drawing books, and she'll do it like the actual like circle with like the triangle and then the box for the chest, and then connect the joints with the circles. And I'm like, wow, like I wasn't even doing that, I was just drawing. Yeah. But she maps it out perfectly, and actually she does a really good job. I'm really, really surprised with her.
That's awesome. Ability.
Yeah, she's super bright. I love her.
That's awesome.
But yeah, and I also teach her like coping skills. I want her to be equipped. Like whenever anything happens in life in the future, I just want her to be super set on learning how to cope. So I've been teaching her, I think since she was like 3 or 4, coping skills. And now it's starting to show out more that she's getting older, which is great, because she walked up to me the other day. She said, "Can we do our positive affirmations?" And I said, "Of course. Yes, ma'am, we will."
I love that.
Yeah, because I used to do it whenever I would braid her hair. I'd be like, you know, "I am beautiful," and then have her say it, "I am smart," and then do it like that, because she struggled with, because she was getting bullied, so she struggled with self-image a lot, which is crazy because she was like 8.
Yeah.
And it like would break my heart. I'm like, ugh. So reinforcing those positive affirmations and challenging those negative thoughts will help. Perception, right? Because as you know, in the military, they say perception is reality.
Yes.
Actually true. Because if we think these things about ourselves, we're kind of training our brain to have these negative thoughts. If you grew up with, like, you know, just a really bad home environment or being bullied, in our head can be echoes from our past, and then we're just, our brain's just reinforcing it with us. So that's why I always teach like my daughter or like my clients how to challenge that negative thinking, because once they do that, and I say, even if you have a good day, do your coping skills, do your positive affirmations. It's going to make a huge difference if you do these things daily. And I've had people who have tried it and are doing amazing. I'm so proud of them. Like, I get all like teary-eyed when I think about it, because I'm like, oh my gosh, you've worked so hard to get to this point, like right now kind of. But I know I'm such a softie when it comes to stuff, but it's gonna help. It's gonna change your overall perception. I usually draw people like a picture when I'm explaining it to them, because it helps me like map out what I'm saying a lot better. But yeah, that's what I like to teach her. And if you have kids, right? I think
I have one. Yeah, I have my one daughter. Okay. She'll be 2 in January.
Yeah, so as soon as she hits like 3, I'd start doing those coping skills.
We do the affirmations already. So,
oh, solid. Does okay.
She know what they mean? Probably not, but she says them.
And yeah, at least it's getting in there.
Yeah, yeah, in her own version of English. So, you know.
It's definitely always easier to like do like early intervention.
Yeah.
Than trying to fix it.
Right.
Later.
Right.
Which it's still possible years later. I don't want to discourage anybody. It's totally possible to change your life around. I tell my clients, like, you're with me 45 minutes, but you're with yourself the rest of the time. So you got to do this stuff, because you're going to be the one ultimately that makes this change. And they have, and I'm super proud of them. And yeah,
So with your clients, you said you work with a lot of high risk clients. Are you working with military? Are you working with civilians? What kind of clients can you take? What kind of insurance do you accept, so that anyone listening that maybe wants to work with you, they kind of know what your scope is and your, you know, quote unquote ideal client?
Yeah. So with the high risk ones, that's in the community mental health. So I'm trying to gear more so away from that, because I've been working in crisis issues for like 6 years, and it's kind of taken a little bit of a toll on me. So I'm gearing towards that private practice moment. And I do really great with like people who've had childhood trauma, because I firmly believe in healing the inner child. Like, I have like a whole thing that goes with that. I do like a meditation with them and kind of walk them back to that. It's like, it's really healing. Anxiety, depression, life stressors, veterans. On the community mental health side, I work with like co-occurring, and I work with people who are struggling with suicidal ideation as their baseline or have like dual diagnosis, like a lot of high risk stuff. But with my practice, I see ages 16 and up because it's solely telehealth, and like younger kids are so hard to like keep on Zoom without them just like wandering around, or, you know. And then anxiety, depression, childhood trauma, PTSD. There's like a whole list of it on like my psychology, which is where all the insurances are listed too, because I don't know all of them off the top of my head.
Do you say Psychology Today? I think it chopped up. Okay, cool. Awesome. We'll make sure to link that. Speaking of finding you and working with you, what is the best way that people can find you to either work with you or support you or reach out to you?
On the Psychology Today website and like the Mindful Therapy, because my practice is contracted with people who do like the intakes and like the billing portion, because I don't know how to do that yet. So they take care of that portion, but they can email me on either of those websites. Both my email is LinkedIn, or there's like a phone number on there that links them to me, so they can easily just call in. And wait, I talk and usually talk to people before their first session anyways to see, fill it out, to see if it's a good fit for them, see if it's a good fit for me, because, you know, it's like a rapport building type of deal. And yeah.
Is it just in the state of Washington or outside of the state? Okay.
I'm only like Washington state. So I can only see people in Washington state. In the future, I'd like to get licensed in other places to kind of broaden out a little bit, but I'm not 100% sure. I think I have to wait until I have that full licensure.
Yeah.
Right now I just have my associate's license and independent clinical work. So,
well, there's definitely a need in Washington. So there's a huge, huge need in Washington for people who do what you do. So thank you for doing what you do and taking part in that positive change towards better mental health in our communities. Cause man, they've been talking about that shortage of mental health providers, obviously on a national scale, but like in this state in particular, it's really, really needed. So, and not everyone's cut out for that work. And so, you know, not everyone goes into that line of work, and that's okay, but we still need a mental health provider. So it can be a very heavy job, and so grateful for you and what you do. To wrap up our episode today, are there any last words or pieces of advice that you want to leave the listeners with?
Yeah. Don't be afraid to reach out for help. Like I said before, you're not alone in this. It's always good, whether you're calling like the crisis line or suicide prevention, the 9881. For veterans, you press 1 on there, or just like seeking out help from like a therapist. You know, it's always good to just have someone to talk to. Because a lot, like I said earlier, a lot of things in life are situational, and you want to be able to work through them so that you can kind of change around for the better and improve those circumstances. So if you feel like you need to reach out to anyone, definitely reach out to the crisis line, 988. You can go on Psychology Today, search any provider in your state. And if you refine the search, you can like look up your insurance, and it'll kind of lead you to providers that cover that, so you're not looking through thousands of pages. Easy site to navigate. If you're in Washington state, I have openings. So just kind of throwing that out there. But yeah, other than that, yeah, don't give up. There's hope. There really is. I know it sounds super cliche, but there's hope out there. Afterwards, I never thought I would see like myself turning 29, but here I am 10 years later and just like doing solid work here. So
thank you for taking the time to listen in today. With your support, we are able to increase awareness of the mental health issues affecting service members and veterans today, with the goal of creating positive change. If you got value from this episode, please take 30 seconds to subscribe and share this episode within your own network. Until next time, remember, your story matters, your mental health matters, and your story doesn't end here.